You're listening to Unveiling Mormonism from PursueGod.org.
So, James and Maddie, I think this is the first time that we've had a brother and sister on the podcast. So thanks for joining us for this. James, you're the big brother. Mm-hmm. Maddie, you're the little sister, 8 years apart. And I think we need to start back on the ostrich farm. So you guys grew up on an ostrich farm, which I think, again, that's another first. I don't think we've had anyone who's grown up on an ostrich farm. Tell me, James, tell me your story in Mormonism.
Yeah, so growing up, we actually started off in Ogden, which isn't too far from here. And there wasn't so populated, so we actually had enough space for an ostrich ranch there. And we ended up moving to Tremonton, and that's where Maddie kind of came in the picture, was when that happened. And when we were over in Tremonton, we had 400 ostriches, so quite a few. And my dad would do everything from fully grown ostriches, and then we would slaughter them, sell the hides, all kinds of stuff, sell their eggs, their huge, huge eggs, to artists. And then he would actually incubate the eggs, crack them open. We did all that. So it was kind of an interesting experience. But yeah, I mean, one of the big things is that my dad, he is a bishop in the LDS Church. He is a really good guy. He is somebody who loves Jesus. And I would say that growing up in the church, there's a lot of things that I didn't realize were going to affect me until much later. One thing that's interesting looking back is I do remember praying on the ranch. I'd be out there and I would sometimes pray. And I remember I'd ask God if I could talk to Jesus, because in the LDS church, they don't really believe in the Trinity. They believe they're separate. And I'd find a lot of peace in those prayers. And anyways, that was kind of my experience growing up and having the ostrich ranch. And my dad taught me a lot of work ethic. Growing up, one of the things I remember him teaching me was we had to dig these fence posts. There was about a football field size pen for every three ostriches. And so we were out there digging, and my dad, he would say, James, come on over here and help me out. And so I'd do like the first little dig with a plastic shovel and throw it over to the side. And then I would run off and get distracted and start playing with a bug or something. And then when he was done with that hole, he'd be like, James, come back over. And then he's like, you know, can you get that last little bit? And I would. And he'd be like, isn't working fun? And I'm like, yeah, this is so fun. Mm-hmm. You know? And so he taught me a lot of really good work ethic. And I would say to this day, like that has really helped me out quite a bit.
That's interesting, because I've heard this, I don't know if you've heard the story, the Mormon parable about how we're saved, according to Mormonism, we're saved by grace after all we can do. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if you guys ever grew up with this, but when you said that about your dad, it made me think of this, is, you know, the father and the son go into a bike shop to buy a bike. Do you know that parable?
I know that story.
And so the kid puts, you know, reaches into his pockets, puts all of his coins on the table. It's nowhere close to enough. And the dad kind of winks at the bike owner, you know, the bike shop owner. And he's like, I'll take care of the rest. And the kid doesn't realize it, but the dad's doing most of the heavy lifting. The kid contributes what he can. So it's interesting that your dad is a bishop. Mm-hmm. He's basically like teaching you, like work hard, do your part, even though really with a plastic shovel, how much can you do?
Right? Dad wasn't a bishop at that time. Bishop currently. He was a scoutmaster.
Yeah.
But it's like the Mormon ethic, right?
It's really just ingrained in you. Like it's how he grew up and was taught about the works based. And he also was working his tail off every summer, baling hay just in the fields. I think he kind of wanted to pass that down because he realized how.
Yeah. Yeah. And I would say that my dad definitely had that in his heart, was to pass it down. Same with my mom. They definitely taught some really good work ethic. And again, that's something that I'm grateful for to this day. The thing I would say, though, is that it got really tough, I would say, especially as you're getting older in your teenage years, because then you start battling with a lot more, you know, your hormones. You're starting to see things differently. You're starting to listen to music that maybe you shouldn't. And I was looking at women in different ways. And it got kind of different then, because it was less about working. It felt like it was less about working with my dad or working on the ranch or doing my best. And it became a lot more about obedience, and not really understanding the why behind all of it. And instead just, I'm supposed to be following this strict line. And it got to a point to where it became very difficult to do that. And so, I mean, I would say that I'm grateful for the work ethic and the discipline, but I would say I'm the God, the Jesus that I got to know, and I would even say the God, because I mean, we were taught that they were separate, that I got to know, eventually that work ethic started turning into something else. It started transforming into, I needed to be able to prove myself to God continually. And that's when things started getting a little bit tough.
So it was, for you, it was like performance-based religion, mm-hmm. but it's one thing to perform digging fence posts and stuff like that. But when it's performing around some of the moral things mm-hmm. that you were like, why, you know, a teenage boy, it's like, I'm going to push back on that.
Yeah.
Right? I'll go dig a trench with my dad, mm-hmm. but you want me to do what?
Yeah.
You know, go to church, mm-hmm. all the different Mormon rules, right? Some of them are biblical, some of them aren't. And so is this where you're starting to push back maybe lifestyle wise against that?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I started pushing back and there was some obvious tension in the house. And I would say, like, looking back, you know, knowing the rules of the religion now, knowing the theology, there's one thing that I look back and I actually really feel for my parents a lot. Which is that if they don't guide me to be good enough, I'm not going to make it to the heaven that they made it to. Mm. And so I can only imagine the pressure that they felt that, because they believe in different tiers of heaven, and they had this pressure to basically make it to where we could all be together forever. Mm-hmm. And so by me not obeying, what's going on in their head, I'm sure, is how do we make sure that James comes with us? How do we make sure that the family stays intact? And as I'm fighting back and I'm not really understanding the why behind a lot of this, I know that, you know, we had to have some conversations, me and my parents, at a pretty young age. And they had to ask me, you know, do you think you're being a good influence to your sisters? And the answer was no. Yeah, I wasn't. I was listening to all kinds of music. I was listening to, rap music and all kinds of things, and confusing the crap out of my parents, I'm sure. But then we just one day we had to have a pretty hard conversation about how my actions were kind of cancerous to the family, which, given their beliefs, they were. And so because of that, the pressure they felt, there was an agreement that it was probably time for me to leave the house. We parted ways.
Like, James, how old are you at this point?
So I would be about 15 years old.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you're 15 years old. Your parents say, this isn't working out.
Yeah.
Now, Maddie, you are?
Seven-ish. Yeah.
Like, how are you? What's little sister thinking about this?
So at that point, I'm a little sponge soaking in my surroundings. Still, you know, in primary, learning all the Mormon doctrine. Say, I already have the checklist. I already have the tithing box. I remember we made tithing boxes, and every weekend when you got allowance, you put it in there. So like, the doctrine is there. I'm learning, soaking it all up. I'm learning the checklist, learning the rules. And then I see my brother is kicked out of the house. I don't even think my parents told us he was gone. Hmm. I think he just didn't come home. And I was like, what happened? And then they talked to me and my sister. Granted, I'm seven. My memory's not the freshest. But they just said he went to live somewhere else to maybe help him correct his actions. His actions haven't been the greatest example to us. Which, that was so hard, because this is my big brother. My brother's my role model. Mm-hmm. Anytime, you know, in those questionnaires you got in school, like, who's your role model? Mm-hmm. It was always James. He was, like, my favorite babysitter, I'm not going to say my favorite sibling, because I love my sisters, but our relationship is just different. It's like more friendship than sibling, in my opinion. So seeing that was the first, I want to say, crack in my shelf of our faith. Because in my brain, how could my parents, who are supposed to love their children more than it, just get rid of one? In my brain, that's how I thought. Mm-hmm. So in my little seven-year-old brain, here I am. Okay. I need to follow the checklist like no other, and I need to be as perfect as I can be, and my works better show, like, I believe everything you're saying. I'm going to follow every rule. I'm not going to break anything. I'm going to make sure I'm being as perfect as I can be so I don't end up homeless either.
Wow. So really, it worked. initially. It worked. That was the goal, right, James? Is we want to send the right message to you and to your sisters that this is not okay.
And I don't know if that was their intention. I really don't. Like, that's confusing to me, is did they do it to send a message to us? Did they want our little brains seeing that to understand, like, if you do this, this is what happens to you? Or is it really they were stuck, not really knowing what to do, seeing what James was doing, and then said, okay, you need to leave without realizing what it's going to do to my psyche as a 7-year-old, seeing my brother kicked out of our home?
Yeah.
And that's where it's confusing. And I don't know where the line was. I don't know what was my parents' actions and what was being, like, how they were being influenced by the church. So that's where it's hard. Lots to unpack there with our childhood. Because it's like, had the church not had that influence on them, would that have been their same actions, you know? And we know that probably not.
Yeah, yeah. And going back to what you were saying before, my dad was a scoutmaster. He was actually my scoutmaster. So we had a lot of great relationships. I mean, I think that it was very confusing emotionally more than anything. But he was, you know, good scoutmaster, somebody that we had a lot of great, great memories with. He taught me a lot. They pushed me to become like an Eagle Scout, which also helped out with a rank when I did join the military later on. So yeah, I mean, it was interesting because I would say that there was never this like malice intent. You could see that, that it was definitely the belief system that really pushed them to say, like, how do I make sure that my family's intact when we go to heaven?
What was your attitude as a 15 year old? Were you like, I get it? Or were you just flipping them the middle finger kind of thing?
Well, because I was trying to understand myself, because I was growing as an individual, there was this tension, this constant tension between me and my parents at that time. And so, to be honest, I actually took it as an invite. Like, I was like, I think this is probably best for all of us. I don't think that I'm in a place where I'm going to be happy here. And I think that I would be happy elsewhere. And I think that that's something that, you know, if anybody like is listening that can relate to this, I would just say, know that when you focus so much on works, whether you're LDS or any kind of Christian, when you focus so much on works and the negative side effects of making mistakes, the thing is that it becomes so much easier to hang out with sinners than it does to try to prove yourself.
So really that pushed you. I mean, I'm not blaming your parents, but that helped nudge you away from Mormonism, from God, from everything. Where did you end up going as a 15-year-old?
Yeah. So at that point, my girlfriend at the time, well, I was actually moving around different places. I lived with a couple of friends, lived in one friend's trailer for a little bit. And then a few weeks later, it so happens that the girlfriend I was with, her mom realized I'd been kicked out of the house, and she offered me to stay with them. And so I did, took them up on that. And it was, you know, her in this situation, the mom was a very kind person, but she was like, you know, you guys can sleep in the same room, but don't be physical. And we're like, thumbs up.
Sure, mom.
My 15-year-old hormones will sure make that happen.
So very, very kind person. I think that was trying to help me, and I took advantage of that.
Yeah.
And so we ended up a few months later, she ended up pregnant. Yeah. And so that was, and then at that point I realized that I kind of had to make a choice. I was playing basketball pretty heavily, but I realized that it was my responsibility to help pay for the house and the rent and everything else that came with it. So I dropped out of high school, picked up a job, and became a cabinet maker. Yeah.
So you're working making cabinets. You have a baby girl.
Yeah.
Baby girl. You're 16 years old. A dad. What happens next? Making cabinets, at some point you're like, I need a career, right?
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I'll be honest. That would have been great if I was that mature, but I actually decided to keep going down this path where, again, so my parents, they did invite me back to the house. When I was, I want to say 18, they did bring me back in the house. So I was there for a little while, but I think that between the friction that we had already kind of created from before, the resentment that everybody was kind of holding on to, it wasn't long before I was like, okay, I remember I can't be here. This is not for me. So then I left and I went and moved in with a guy that it was a drug house. You know, like I said, it was just easier to go and do these things with people that I felt accepted by. And so, yeah, and this is where I started making some even worse decisions. But it was a place to live. I thought these guys were my friends. And then I actually ended up going to the fairgrounds. I was dating a lot of women at the time. I was, and I thought that I was being chivalrous, that if I told a woman, hey, I'll date you, but when I'm not with you, I'm free to do what I want. Mm. For some dumb reason, I thought that that was, you know, chivalrous, and I'm like, oh, well, I told them, so it's fine. And so anyways, I ended up going to the fairgrounds one day. And I'm doing my thing, looking for validation from women, and I'm getting a fair amount, but there's just this one person that wants nothing to do with me, this one woman, and it drove me crazy. And so I tried to get her number, and she didn't want anything to do with me, so she said no. And then later I saw her at a party again, and I actually got her phone number from my current girlfriend, which was, such a, you know, bad move, but it worked out because now she's my wife.
Okay.
She's playing
hard to get.
Yeah. And she was. She didn't want anything to do with how I was living.
Sure.
And when we were at the, when I was living in this house with all the drugs, and basically one day something really bad happened. I heard somebody scream inside the house. I was outside. So I ran to the door. It was locked. So I kicked the door in. And I remember when I went inside, somebody was really hurt. There was a woman that was really hurt. Mm. And when I went in to confront her, she was afraid of me. And I remember just thinking to myself, like, okay, I've gone way too far here. I'm somewhere that I shouldn't be. And so then there's one person that I knew had values, one person in my phone that I could talk to. And so I called her, and she made an exception as long as I didn't make any moves on her.
Mm.
And so, yeah.
And that's your wife.
That's
now.
My wife now.
Oh.
Yeah. She set me straight.
So Maddie, for you, let's go back to the ostrich farm.
Okay.
At this point now, while all this stuff is going on with your brother, you're this, you know, elementary aged and then junior mm-hmm. high age girl who is just like trying to do the right thing, choose the right, as the Mormons
yes.
would say.
Yes, mm-hmm. I had all the choose the right rings.
Yeah.
It was a reminder daily.
And did you have any like sense for what James was doing, or is he just off doing his own thing, living his own life?
Nope. James is off what I think living his best life. Mm. And he has a daughter. He had her when I was 9.
Okay.
So I got the little sister I always wanted.
Yeah.
I don't think you had much time with Izzy when she was the baby. She would come to my mom and dad's house on James's weekend.
Okay.
And so I got to play big sister, and it was the best thing ever. So although that was like what people would say a mistake, it was not for me. Mm-hmm. You know, like I got a little best friend, and mm-hmm. she still is one of my little best friends. So I get emotional because I just love her. So I was 9 when Izzy was born. What's funny is I didn't even find out I was having a niece from my family. I found out from my best friend. I'm like, what? I'm going to be an aunt? Like, who? You know? And so that was weird. I was like, why didn't my mom and dad tell me? Mm-hmm. And I think it's because they were trying to avoid that talk. Because I'm 10. I'm 9. Mm-hmm. Like, they're like, probably trying to avoid a hard conversation of like, how is my 16-year-old brother having a baby? He's not married. Because in my mind, that happens in marriage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I never got that talk from my parents. I got it from my grandmother. So we were spared.
Oh, good. So we don't have to do it right now?
No, luckily.
I was getting ready. I wasn't sure if that's where this was heading.
But. No, luckily my grandma filled me in. I understood how I was having a niece. And she was not happy about it, but
some of our listeners are really disappointed. If you need that conversation, that'll be on another episode.
Yeah.
I mean, so for you, you have more relationship with his daughter than you do with him.
I do. I had more relationship with her than him. He went away to the military, so she was around a lot while he was in the military. So back to my Mormon story, that first kind of like, whoa, my brother just got kicked out and this is what he was doing. I have to make sure I don't do that. I have to make sure I read my scriptures. I say my prayers. I pay my tithing. I go to church every week. I have good friends. I don't look or listen to anything bad. At that time, James, I'm going to throw you under the bus. I found one of his pornography videos stashed somewhere in our living room. And I looked at the cover and I was like, what is this? And I didn't tell anybody. But then my friend came over and I was like, do you know what this is? And she's like, yeah, like we should watch it. I'm like, I don't think, no. Like I was like, I can't do that. Like my brother got kicked out probably for this. So I was like, can't look at anything bad. Can't listen to rap music. Can't.
I love that rap music is the bad guy here. This is
but that's how orthodox our family was.
That's actually, I would say, a central point was the rap music.
Really? He created his own album.
To rebel, I started rapping. Yeah.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
It was more than listening.
Yes. And so rap music was a big theme. And I was like, couldn't listen to Eminem. Couldn't listen to James's music. So.
You're like, Dad, I just want to rap about ostriches.
Exactly. So that is when, in those formative years of like preteen, I was all in. I said, this church is going to save me. I'm not going to end up like my brother. I'm going to be the best Mormon girl I can be because I'm taught this is how I will live the best and happiest life. This is how I'll find a husband one day if I'm pure and if I'm perfect. This is how I will make it back to God. And that's the ultimate goal. In Mormonism, your ultimate goal is making it to the celestial kingdom so that you could be a God one day. And that sounded amazing to me. I was like, ooh, I cannot wait to create my own world. Like, I was like planning it out in my brain.
So that's- it just dawns on me. It strikes me that James... You were a good Mormon for a period of time too. I think everyone listening can relate to this, that everyone can make it for a period of time, right?
Yeah.
So maybe you made it till you were 12 or 13. It sounds, Maddie, like you made it a little bit further than
I
that.
I did, yeah. So I'll go back to that. Around 12, our wards were split. My dad was put into a bishopric. I was brand new in Young Women's. My mom, I think, was in Young Women's as well. So even at church, I felt like I had to perform, that I had to, you know, make my parents proud because they're in leadership now. I want to be that good daughter that people are like, oh, wow, like they raised such good kids. So that's when the scrupulosity started. And for those that are listening and don't know what that is, scrupulosity is religious OCD. So I actually had checklists. Every night I would make sure I read my scriptures that day. I prayed, you know, at every meal, said my nighttime prayers. I would make goals to like read the full Book of Mormon. I never made goals to read the Bible because the Bible confused me. And I knew that it didn't really matter because the Book of Mormon was like the foundation of our beliefs. So that's what I did. I just went all in. I wanted to make my parents proud. I wanted to become a god one day. I wanted to be a wife one day. I wanted to marry somebody in the temple. They really put a focus on temple marriage starting at 12 years old. That's your main goal.
For a woman.
For a woman. Like, it's kind of like you get married and that's your life now. Which, that was hard because I was like, okay, I have to be perfect so that when I get old enough, I can marry a returned missionary. I was not perfect, of course. Only one person who walked this earth has been perfect. And I would get really down on myself, even if I just like said a swear word. I was like, I need to talk to the bishop. Like, I can't believe that came out of my mouth. If I was mean to somebody at school, I also felt like I just had to like... repent over and over. Our God in Mormonism is very conditional. So I felt like I always was just like, well, if I over repent, then I'm covered, right? So that was kind of like my teenage years. It turned where I got kind of suicidal there because I was like, this, no matter what I do, I can't do enough. There's always something that I could be doing more of.
Are you telling anyone this?
No.
Are you, like, would your parents know your struggles internally at this point?
I told my mom I had, like, self-image issues.
Okay.
That's what it was disguised as, like, oh, I'm just not confident. I'm going through puberty. Like, my mom took me to therapy. I told the therapist, like, I hate myself. I sometimes want to harm myself because I'm just not good enough. Like, no matter what I do, I'm not good enough. I hate my body because it doesn't look like the other Mormon girls in my church, you know? I'm not as popular as them because for me it didn't matter about making friends because all I cared about was just making sure I was following the rules of the church. I also had like this boyfriend, starting in eighth grade, and he was kind of my boyfriend all through high school, and he was not a member. So I always felt so guilty about that. He was the kindest boy ever. He was my best friend. I will always have love for him. He taught me how I think a woman should be treated. And I just knew, like, I'm sinning being, like, they called it going out. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I'm sinning going out with you. Like, you'll never be able to take me to the temple. So we're never going to put a label on it. Like, I love you. Essentially, I was in love with him by 16. But we'll never be able to label it, because then that's probably worse. You know, and so I think that contributed to my religious OCD too, is I knew I was kind of like in my brain sinning by dating a guy who wasn't a member. So I was like, okay, it's fine. I'll just outwork the sin. You know, like, I'll be more religious. I was even on seminary council. That's like the leadership, the youth lead. It's like student body presidency, but of seminary. So I was
seminary on, is the Mormon, like, youth group connected to the high school.
Yeah, right. Yep. And we had release time seminary. So we would walk over for an hour a day. In seminary, I really struggled. I'm a very, I don't know how to explain it. I research things. And if I can't find an answer, I get really frustrated. Or even if I don't find an answer, but I just don't feel like it's making sense, I get really frustrated. So I remember in seminary, I had this seminary teacher. I had him 5 times in a row. And that's, like, unheard of. And it was the one everybody did not like. I got along with him fine. I didn't care. It was seminary. I just wanted to learn about Mormonism, you know? And I remember questioning something about the afterlife one day, about God. I was really confused about how, like, our God came from a God, but then what God did they come from? And, like, when did it end and when did it start? And, like, what was the actual creation? Like, and I was voicing this in front of everybody, and he got very upset for me bringing up these concerns. And I was like, why are you shutting me down? Like, I need answers. Like, I'm struggling. And so that's kind of where my struggle began, was in seminary.
So for you, Maddie, it was more, I'm going to label these like some theological cracks in the shelf.
Yes.
For you.
Mm-hmm.
But James, back to your story, for you, a lot of this was just lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, you wanted to be your own guy and live your own way, but you're still kind of stuck in this performance trap, mm-hmm. right? That mm-hmm. this work ethic that your dad taught you from a young age that didn't work out for you in religion, but now you end up finding the same trap in the military.
Yeah. So I would say that it's one that probably stemmed from when I was younger, when we decided to go our separate ways as a family so that I wouldn't continue to influence my sisters in a negative way. I think that kind of is where I started some abandonment issues, to be honest. I think that I was wanting to find family. I was wanting to find acceptance. And I learned that if I performed a certain way in most situations, then I would have at least a moment of acceptance. And so when all this went down and I called my wife and she befriended me and we started hanging out a lot. It was after a few weeks. So we'd known each other over a year at this point. I've been chasing her. And after 2 weeks of, like, hanging out, and she realized, like, I was serious. I wanted to change. She was like, yeah, we can date. And I was like, all right. And then it was a few weeks later, I'm like, all of a sudden this responsibility starts hitting me. I have a daughter that doesn't have a great role model as a father. And I have this person that I would like to, you know, advance our relationship, but I don't have much to offer. And so at that point, I remember one night we were hanging out and we started watching Tears of the Sun, old military movie. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, man, these guys are nuts. I love this. And I'm like, man, I wonder if I could go do that, because they're kind of crazy. And they're after adrenaline, all the things that I thought were cool. So then I started going to different recruiting stations, and all the stations were telling me all the cool stuff they could offer. And then I went to the Marine Corps, and they're like, "We don't want you." And I'm like, "I gotta have this one,
just like your wife,
yeah.
Right?
Yep.
This is the way to James's heart. Just play hard to get.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. The chase. So they told me I had to go get my diploma. I sped through that. I worked my butt off and got my diploma in about a month, and joined. Told my girlfriend at the time, hey, I'm going to go join the Marine Corps. I need to get some structure in my life. And in the back of my head the whole time, I think I'm really still just trying to prove something to myself and those around me. So yeah, I go to boot camp. go through all the training that happens there, the identity transformation process. And yeah, it was pretty interesting. But I remember this is something I don't think I've ever shared this publicly in any way, but we ended up training our butt off. We ended up getting to what's called the Crucible, which is kind of like boot camp, Marine Corps boot camp version of Hell Week, and going through all the stuff. And then at the very end, I actually have pneumonia at the time. And I didn't want to tell anybody because I didn't want to get rolled back. Mm. And my parents and my girlfriend are going to come out and see me for graduation. So I'm like, I got to make this happen. So I didn't tell anybody. And it's the last hill of boot camp. And I have nothing left in the tank. And so one of these drill instructors that actually saw some potential in me kind of pushed me up the hill, broke the rules by pushing me up the hill, by the way. And unfortunately, the other drill instructor, he saw this and wasn't a big fan of mine. And so when they're handing out the Eagle Globe and Anchors, when he handed me mine, he's like, just so you know, you didn't deserve this. And so then it was one more thing of like, man, I got to prove myself. And so yeah, I mean, I kept on going down that path, ended up going the infantry route. So then I went to school of infantry, joined the infantry battalion later, did some more advanced training with them, and then deployed to Afghanistan. We were there for 6 months, saw some combat, and then came back. And yeah, I mean, it was interesting because when I came back, I remember when I came back, I asked my girlfriend to officially marry me, and we ended up getting married, and it was great. But when I came back home to visit, I remember going to like the LDS church. I was going to surprise my parents and let them know, like, I'm back from deployment. Or, well, actually, let me phrase this. I forget. I'm sorry. They came to see me. So it was later. I apologize for that. My memory's kind of lapsing right now. But yeah, I came back from deployment. Yeah, I'm going to stop there because I'll go off on a tangent.
Yeah.
I can keep talking. So.
So for you, what are you learning in the Marine Corps at this point? Are you finding family? Are you finding acceptance? Are you kind of hitting the marks that you need to perform in the military?
Yeah, so I'm hitting all the marks I need to. When I was what they call a boot, when you're a new guy, they call you a boot. When I was a boot or a rookie, I was checking all the marks. I was kind of in line to become the next squad leader of the squad. Had a really good friend, and yeah, really, really good friend. And I'm going to throw out, we'll just call him Jammer. And anyways, really good friend, close, like a really good friend. Like, we're not talking performance-based friend, like an actual friend. Mm-hmm. And he was actually sent there because he got caught smoking weed by his dad, and his dad was a Baltimore chief of police, so he gave him an option. You know, you can either get in trouble for this legally or you can go join the Marine Corps. Mm. So anyways, we meet, we have a good friendship, but then when I was in the Marine Corps, they used to have this really, it's not a great culture when it comes to developing. And they used to do this thing where they would actually try to see if they could get the boots to kill themselves. It was a fun game for the senior Marines. And, you know, they considered it funny, sarcastic. They'd call it a game. And the thing is like, I remember thinking to myself, like, they don't mean it. It's just like some twisted thing that they're saying and playing, like almost like a fraternity. Mm-hmm. But anyways, you knew that they would take any opportunity they could to just see if you were going to be able to make it to combat and be mentally and emotionally strong enough. So there were some disruptions that were happening back home. I was missing my daughter. There was a lot of things that weren't working out well for me. And they were things I had to really kind of just bottle up, hide. I would tell Jones, and Jones would kind of help me when I would start having like emotional outbreaks. He'd kind of like basically help me to not show it to any of my senior leaders, because then they would use that against me. So no, I did not find really the family that I was looking for. Mm. And yeah, and I would say even overseas, like when we were overseas and we came back, I was expecting to feel like we were this tight-knit family. But to be honest, there was just drugs running rampant through the barracks. I remember I was looking for a team leader one day, and didn't see him for a long time. So I go to his room, knock on the door, opens the crack, I go in there, and he's got drugs laying around. And he's like, hey man, this is how you cope. He invited me in. Mm-hmm. And so the first time I'd say I really connected with any of my senior leaders was when they invited me in to do some drugs. And,
wow.
Yeah. And so this is the way it is. So definitely different than what I expected.
So did that become an issue for you then when you eventually got out of the Marines?
Yeah. I mean, so As far as when you say issue, do you mean like the acceptance part or?
Well, the drug use.
The drug use.
Was drug use like more of a thing now for you introducing your story?
Yeah. So then, yes, for sure. I would say that at the time I started to do some of the drugs that they were using in the barracks at the time. But I saw between the lines. I mean, I saw people getting kicked out for it. So I'm like, I got to stop. Mm-hmm. And so fortunately, I stopped I stopped in time to not get in trouble. And I was able to kind of finish my time with the Marines. But I would say that I definitely picked up alcoholism and didn't realize it because it's so ingrained in the Marine Corps. Mm-hmm. Especially the infantry, that I was drinking excessively. I would say that before I converted to Christianity a couple of years ago, I was drinking on average, I would say at least a quarter of a bottle a night. And that's me trying to like count maybe the days that I didn't drink anything. But it wasn't unheard of for me to be drinking a bottle in a night. That was pretty typical.
And bring in beer to family dinners.
Yeah.
Harder stuff.
Yep. Yeah.
Maddie, how is that? Because some of our listeners maybe don't understand Mormon culture, but like you don't pull beer out, any kind of alcohol at a family function if there's Mormons around.
He'd wrap it in a paper bag and we're like, we're not dumb, just pull it out. at that time, I'm still we're all still active. Mm-hmm. We're all still gung-ho Mormons. It didn't really affect me. I was just like, well, he's gone astray. My parents would just say, just pray for him that he'll find his way back. There was lots of prayer for him while he was overseas. Mm-hmm. So much prayer. I feel like our family grew closer together, bonding over him being gone. My dad followed so much of what was going over there, and we could see the worry. And I know there was times we were worried we wouldn't even see him again, which was really hard. So I felt during that time like, hey, I gotta be the best Mormon I could be, because it's going to be, if I'm showing how devoted I am to you, God, please protect my brother. So just praying all the time that he find. So that's kind of how our family dynamic was while he was gone. When he got back and was dealing with alcoholism, I didn't know it was alcoholism. I just was drinking a lot. Our relationship really kind of went on the back burner. We were just in different phases of life. I was graduating high school. Was I, or was I still in high school while you were gone? I think I was middle school still.
Still in high school.
I'm just like teenage girl. Sure. Like I am trying to live life, be accepted in high school. I like boys, you know, like I'm hanging out with friends, doing seminary council. Like my life was just like in the church. Like I didn't really pay attention to what my brother was doing other than I knew he was gone and he'd write me letters. Mm. And then when he got back, we still didn't see him much. He was stationed in Hawaii for 2 years?
Four.
4 years. So I never went to see him. So I didn't see my brother for like 5 years, I think. Mm-hmm. He'd come home and surprise us. I saw him right when he got home, a few months after he got home from Afghanistan. But other than that, our relationship there was a distance there, which is very sad. Because now I see how our relationship is. I'm like, dang, like I could have used him. I went through the hardest moments of my life while our relationship wasn't really close. Yeah.
James, for you then, will you get out of the military eventually? You're back with, now you're with your wife. Is like, how would you describe your early marriage with, coming back from the Marines?
Yeah, I would say that it was strained. I mean, my wife got pregnant. So in my first deployment, I did my only deployment. And after that, I had a really bad knee injury from a helicopter. Basically, we were training, jumped out of a helicopter before it had completely landed and really jacked up my knee. And so for the longest time, because of the high performance, when you're in a team like that, you really just don't, you kind of hide it so that you don't get pulled off the team.
Yeah.
And so that's what I was doing. She was worried because we're going back on deployment soon. And so she's like, she's really worried. And she's like, I want to have a baby with you. Cause if I lose you, I want to have something to remember you by. So, she ended up getting pregnant and then they ended up doing the knee surgery. My squad leader, was a great dude at the time. I was frustrated with him, but he started seeing my limp. He started seeing I wasn't performing as well. So then he basically pushed on me like, you need to get your surgery. If you're healed in time, you can come back with us. But if you're not, you're not going. And so at that point, I get my knee surgery, but she starts getting so much morning sickness that she has to come back home. She can't be on the island. She needs some help. And I'm not there a lot of the time. I'm out training or I'm working on different things. And so she ends up going home. And by the time I get back home, it's pretty strained at this point. It's getting kind of tough because we're so used to living on a military salary, which they work with you and they make it work. And then I got home and I had no idea how to have a real job. And so then I started doing like splicing fiber optics and I wasn't making enough. I had to pay for my gas and my maintenance of my truck to get from state to state. And I was making, I want to say I was making $18 an hour. So between everything, I just couldn't do it. There was times I literally had to ask for gas at gas stations. There was a point where we didn't have enough money. So I actually had to start stealing baby formula from the store so we could feed our daughter. So, I mean, she was in a tough situation because she was so used to living this life with me. And then I think that over time I started leaning heavier and heavier and heavier into the alcohol. To just cope with things, cope with my own incompetence is what it was feeling like. And, so it was pretty strained and from there, basically I joined the National Guard at that point and, supported, the group out in Draper, Utah. And after that, I realized like, I pretty much feel like I have one group of people I kind of know how to roll with and be with, which is kind of your protective groups. So then I joined into the security world and I made a pretty decent career out of that, kind of got into the corporate side of things, found another high pressure environment to seek high performance.
So for you, that was still the holy grail.
Yeah.
You're still trying to find validation through performance.
Yeah.
So how'd that story end up leading you to meeting Jesus?
So yeah, for me, it basically got to the point to where I was doing security for Homeland Security. I was working with a company that contracts for them. And one thing led to another. I was looking for different career moves to make myself more successful. And I didn't realize that ultimately what I was doing in the back of my head was wanting my wife to worship me. I was wanting this validation that was beyond validation. It was like it was self-worship. And so continue on that path, ended up leaving that job. I went and became like a technician in alarms to learn how to do more. So then I can basically go and become an executive in security. I would expand my knowledge and it worked. I became a head of security for a cannabis company and went through the ranks. We ended up moving out to Arizona and life actually seemed pretty good. I think mostly because I was just so busy that I wasn't able to process any of the negative that was happening or that I was doing. And at this point I had actually become, I don't think I ever actually stopped believing in God, but at this point I told myself I didn't because it was just easier, I think. And anyways, that one thing led to another. I was looking for validation with my employers, with my employees, with women that weren't my wife. And being the leader of the family, I created a lot of toxicity. And so me and my wife, we just kept on fighting and fighting and fighting and fighting until it got to the point to where we're broken. We were both broken. And I remember this is the first time ever I just said, like, she's like, I think that we might be done. And I said, I agree. I got the papers, like, we're done. And, finally, I mean, she said, hey, you know, I found this church that I want to go to. And she said, well, first she was really wise. And she's like, if we can make it 1 week without being hostile towards each other, are you comfortable with trying one more week? And I was like, yeah, what does that hurt? And then it was a week later, we hadn't talked to each other, so we didn't get in a fight. And then she was like, I found this church. Do you want to go with me? And to be honest, like it's really bad looking back, but I was so focused on high performance that I was like, I've seen a lot of Christians that seem to have this psychological edge over other people. I'm going to go to this church and figure out what that edge is and add it to my toolbox. And went to the church. And the first time I remember feeling dazed, like what just happened? You know, what did I just hear? This isn't what I remember. And by the time I went back the next week, the church was empty. I was crying for another half hour, you know, and realized that, that I had been seeking the wrong thing.
So you just like, I always love to hear people's stories because it was more of like, you might almost say like a coin flip, like, let's give it a shot. Mm-hmm. Sure, I'll go to church, wrong reasons, but you end up hearing the word of God, which never returns void, and you meet Jesus.
Yeah. And, I mean, that's the thing now is it's The one thing I would tell people is, you know, if you grew up in the LDS church, and regardless of whether you did or not, if you are feeling this emptiness and this burnout and this, you're chasing validation and acceptance, that for me, I'm at a point now where I, for the first time in my life, I actually do feel like real love. And I know that sounds cheesy, and it feels even cheesy saying it, but I actually feel real acceptance and love from Christ.
And it's not conditional.
And it's not conditional. It's not transaction. Yeah.
Maddie, did you see that then? So as far back as you can remember, this is not James.
No.
does James at some point, does this information get to you? That, yeah, James and his wife are going to church, that they're Christians?
Yeah, he started talking about Jesus at family dinners, and I was like, what happened to you? I have not heard the name Jesus out of your mouth. I don't even remember the last time. I didn't know he believed in anything. I know at some point he was worshiping the devil, like into Ouija boards and Satan. So yeah, it was a shock, mm-hmm, when I was like, I think I leaned over my sister. I was like, did he just say Jesus? Like, weird. So yeah, it was very interesting to see.
And where was your, at that point, where was your, what was your relationship like with Mormonism?
At that point, I had been away from the church for 5 years. Mm. I had gone through a marriage, ended that marriage due to some abuse, and I had remarried. I had two kids, my current husband. Yeah. So I had been away from the church for 5 years at that point. I never stopped believing in God. God was always there. Granted, he was a different version of God than the Christian God. He was still transactional. I was still disappointing him in my mind. I think I still felt the Mormon church was the true church, I say in quotes, but I just didn't want anything to do with it. I said, God, just please love me how I am, because I can't give anything else right now. There was really bad experiences I had in my previous marriage that just kind of, I gave up on everything. Gave up on God, but didn't stop believing in him, if that makes sense. So I was, at that point when James found Jesus, I was listening to Christian sermons online, Joyce Meyer, you know, the Elevation Church. I was listening to worship music. I just wasn't really deconstructing, because I didn't know there was anything to deconstruct. Like, I didn't know Mormonism was so different than biblical Christianity. Mm-hmm. And then when I saw them, him and Nicole, come to Jesus, find, mm-hmm, Jesus, I was like, whoa, there's something there, and it has changed them, and I've never seen them like this. I've never seen their marriage so good. Mm-hmm. I've never seen their family dynamic so good. So then it was like, hey, I want what they have, and it's not Mormonism. So I was turned on to the pursuegod.org, and I went crazy and started my deconstruction. And it's crazy, the differences between what I was taught and what is in the Bible. It was shocking. And
yeah, because very for eye-opening. You, growing up Mormon, this is good for our non-Mormon listeners to hear this, for our Christian listeners to hear this. Like, you thought, you genuinely, both of you genuinely thought you were Christians.
Oh, yeah.
Like Baptists or Methodists.
100%. And that's another thing that happened. There was a comment on, like, this Crunchy Moms Facebook group, because I'm pretty crunchy. And it was a Christian Crunchy Moms Facebook group. And someone's like, hey, I was asked if I was a Christian and I'm a Mormon. And I said yes. And I got like an earful of how I'm not. And she was like, how do I respond? And I was like, well, we are like Mormons are Christian. You're taught the teachings of Christ. Doesn't that make you Christian? And everybody came after me, and I can take criticism. I don't care. Like, mm-hmm, Facebook comments don't bug me. They're like, are you crazy? Like, you are not Christian. You believe Jesus is your brother, that he volunteered to save you, and that he's like you. Like, that is not Christianity. And I was so confused. I was like, what? I went to my dad. My dad's a bishop at this time. I'm like, Dad, are Mormons not Christian? Like, look, this happened on Facebook, this conversation, and now I'm confused. And I was trying to defend the church, even though I wasn't really believing or going. Sure. This was before James, you know, found Jesus and of the Bible. And my dad's like, well, in a way, like, Mormons aren't. Like, I can see why they would say that. Like, we believe, you know, Christ is like us. We believe we can become gods. That's not what Christians believe about the Trinity. And I was like, okay, that's weird. Because well, you raising me my whole life, I thought I was Christian. Mm-hmm. And now I realize I wasn't Christian. Like, what?
Mm-hmm. Well, when your dad was younger in the church, they taught him mm-hmm. that their Mormons aren't Christians. 100%. That's what they taught. It's only in the last probably 15 or maybe 20 years that the Mormons have now totally changed it and said, we're Christians.
I think they're rebranding. Because I think with all there is out there on social media and all this, like, they need to rebrand to be able to, like, keep the younger generation in the church that they want to be Christian. But in my opinion, I don't feel like they are Christian
based on their doctrine. It's probably time to update the episode on that. Maybe we'll do that here early this year as our Mormons Christians really help. Mm-hmm. Help to answer that in a biblical way, but not in a mean way.
Yeah.
No, and I'm not meaning it mean. I have no ill intent. Yeah. I have family who's Mormon. I respect them. You know, the Mormon church did teach us good values. We're very family centered. We love hard. We work hard. There are some good things that came from it. So I don't want to discredit that my parents taught us. But on the other hand, the doctrine of the Mormon church is not biblical, nor is it Christian in the sense God is not human.
Yeah.
He does not have a body. He's not eating in heaven. He's not going to edit this out. I was about to say pooping in heaven.
No, like, we're not going to edit that out.
In the Mormon church, he has a human body.
Yeah, right.
And it's like, well, no, God's not human.
Right.
Jesus is human and Jesus is God, but
God
is not human. There's just so much that's different.
Well, and Mormons have said that forever too. So it's an interesting, I'm already thinking about this next episode, but maybe the better question is, are Mormons evangelical Christians? Because I think all Mormons would say, no, we're not evangelical Christians.
I don't think most Mormons would know what that is.
I don't think really? So either.
Yeah. Mm-mm. Oh, that's interesting. Because I feel like that's, evangelicals are who Mormons throw under the bus, is my understanding. Is they're like, you guys are the ones that say grace is a license to sin.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Mormons think, I don't want to speak for all Mormons because there is it's different across the board. But I think when you leave the church, people look at it as permission to sin, especially if you leave the church and you become an evangelical Christian, because in the Bible, it's not works. It's like, in order to be saved in heaven, you say, Jesus, you died on the cross for me. I'm a sinner. I know through you I can be saved. And I've tried explaining this to my like Mormon family. Like, it's not works that will save you. It's your belief in Christ and his atonement for you.
It's his work. Yeah, that's right. Okay. Yeah, it's atonement. Atonement's the right word, but it means something different.
But it's not the atonement in Mormonism. Yes, that's right. In Mormonism, the atonement happened in the Garden of Gethsemane.
That's right.
In Christianity, the atonement was Jesus dying on the cross.
Yeah.
And that's why the cross is so important to us, because that was the ultimate sacrifice so we could be saved. To live with, you know.
Look at you, Maddie. You're getting it.
I'm like a baby Christian for sure. I was telling you, I'm like 2 days old. I know who my father is and I know where to go to get like the meat or the milk. Mm-hmm. But I am still learning. I hear that for every decade you're in the Mormon church, it's like a year or more to deconstruct that. And it's just mind blowing.
Yeah.
And I do think there's resources lacking for people who came out of the Mormon church who want to find God of the Bible, because a lot of Mormons think, okay, if this wasn't true, nothing's true. Mm. You know, I kind of felt like that there when I was like, oh my gosh, it was all a lie.
You know what Jesus's idea for providing resources is? You two. And all the listeners who've come out of Mormonism. I mean, it's about being a disciple maker, being someone, just what you're saying, Maddie, is going to your friends and trying to help them understand in language that they understand. You're so much more suited to reach your friends than I am, because you've been in their shoes. You've lived their life. You know what you guys are talking about. You know you live this story just like they're living the story.
Yeah.
And so you are the resource. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously resources like this podcast, that's why we do the podcast. Obviously, God's word is the best resource. But I guess maybe on that note, James, speak to the Mormon, or so, you know, it's maybe not like a, I don't know that like a all in Mormon would get this far in an episode. Mm-hmm. So speak to the Mormon who's maybe on the fence. And they're still just in truly like seeking this out. Like, what does the gospel mean to you now that you've read the Bible, you go to a Christian church? How are all those things so different than what you understood in this performance-based religion of Mormons?
Well, I would say that when I was younger, we focused on the Book of Mormon. We didn't focus on the Bible. I would say that learning about the Bible, specifically the New Testament, one thing that I love is that it's very clear that Jesus is going after specific people that are far from perfect, and he's calling them to walk with him. And so I think for me now, where I was always trying to prove something before, it's kind of like that story where, you know, my dad was asking me to dig the hole with him. It feels like Jesus, God, is asking me to just work with him. Not because he needs me, but because he wants me there. And that feeling is something that for me has brought me not only a lot of peace, but a lot of energy and excitement that I've never felt before, because I don't feel like I have to prove anything. And I go back to so me and my wife, we read the word every morning. A few mornings we don't, we watch a sermon. But I would say that I get so much peace out of reading the Bible now and knowing Jesus's heart. That's helped me a ton. I'd also say, like, I've always thought, like, you know, the rule breaker, right? Like, I've always been like, man, I'm a rule breaker. I can't be perfect. So how am I ever going to make it? And I remember watching an episode of The Chosen where it showed Jesus kind of like running out to the lake to become cleansed because a woman who needed to be healed had touched his robe and she was healed. And I remember her asking, like, did the Pharisee send you here to get cleaned? And he's like, yeah, he thought he did. We just wanted to come swim. And it's funny because as I read the Bible, I can totally see the personality they put on him in The Chosen. And there's just this love that he has for people that are not perfect. And again, I would say that if you're feeling like you're overwhelmed and you can't, you're not enough, I would just challenge you to go to a church. Don't just open the Bible. Go to a local Christian church where you can hear somebody who has been a student of the Bible, who can help you understand it deeper. And if you do that, I mean, what does it hurt? Just go and see if you feel different, see if you feel the Spirit.
How has it changed your marriage? You know, you were a week away from calling it quits. Mm. And now what's your marriage like?
Mm. Well, I mean, now I would say that because I've had to go inward, I've been able to accept a lot of ownership for the things that I did wrong. My wife has done the same thing. She is by far my best friend. Even right now, she's sick. I left work a little bit early just to go take her some medicine, see how she's doing. I missed her. And that's the funny part. I could be gone for 20 minutes and I miss her. And if there are times when I still fall back, because I do, when I still fall back to feeling like I'm not good enough, she's the person that helps me remember that I am.
James and Maddie, thanks for sharing your story.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. If you haven't already, please consider rating our podcast. It's a simple way to help us reach more people. Find more resources to talk about these topics with your small group, family, or mentor on pursuegod.org.